Good morning, everyone. Greg, I understand you want to start us off today.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct?
Yep. Good morning. In case of an emergency, we will egress through the main doors or closest exit, which are illuminated by an exit sign. We will assemble on the lawn of the National Building Museum. An automated external defibrillator is located behind the guard desk. Fire extinguishers are strategically located throughout the building, and the restrooms are past the guard desk on the left. Today's safety contact will focus on receiving the flu vaccine this season. Last year, the vaccine prevented over 5 million illnesses and over 85,000 hospitalizations. The CDC recommends that everybody 6 months of age and older get a vaccine every season. In addition to the vaccine, the CDC recommends avoiding close contact with those who are sick, staying at home when you are sick, routinely washing your hands, and practicing good health habits such as getting plenty of sleep, being physically active, and managing your stress. Thank you for your time today, and please stay healthy during this holiday season.
Greg, thank you. And I'd like to welcome everyone to this special meeting of the Finance and Capital Committee, which is focused on the General Manager's proposed fiscal year 2020 budget as presented to this committee 2 weeks ago. I've spoken to Dennis and Paul, and they promise there will be no fire alarms going off when difficult questions appear. To begin with, though, I'd like to see if there's any objections to today's agenda. Seeing none, the agenda is approved as presented. Next, may I have a committee member's approval of the minutes from November 1st?
So moved.
Thank you. Is there a motion? Second. Okay. The minutes are approved. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. The minutes are approved. So before I turn the floor over to Dennis and his team, I'd like to outline the structure and expected outcome for today's meeting. Mr. Wiedefeld put forward his proposed 2020 budget and capital improvement program 2 weeks ago, which marked the start of a months-long process of deliberation and consultation with our riders and jurisdictional partners that will conclude in the spring of 2019. Today, the board members will be discussing and refining budget options to take out to the public for its input through the public outreach process. To prepare for today's meeting, board members submitted questions in advance to help frame our discussion. After today's discussion, we anticipate approving a docket of options for public comment on December 13th. So today's meeting is an important step to move forward to seek public input in January and February. So with that, I will turn the floor over to Dennis, who's going to make a presentation, address it, answering a lot of the questions that were put forth, and then we will have an open Q&A session following that. Dennis.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Well,
sure. I just want to emphasize that given Tuesday's announcement with Amazon, I think this 20 budget just has taken on a new level of significance as we start to ramp up and prepare for what's coming to the region, you know, in a positive way, and how Metro is going to be such an important player in that. So I think as we start to think about the 20 budget, I think it's good for us all to keep that in mind, that the region's changing around us very quickly, and we need to, and Transit can play a large part in that, and we need to step to the plate for that.
And Paul, I'd like to say I saw your comments on the news. I wasn't able to make it to the session the other day in Arlington, but your comments were right on target. That without what has been done to improve Metro over the last number of years and getting the dedicated funding and the improvements that have happened under your leadership, we probably would not have been able to make that positive announcement for the region. So congratulations to you and your team as well.
Thank you. But again, that issue was driven by this board. A lot of those, we got to that because of the leadership of this board and Chairman Evans, I think. In particular, and then obviously what played out in Annapolis and Richmond and at the Wilson Building all supported the delivery of that very, very large prize that the region just got.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to report board member Dorsey and myself were out last weekend with the Metro team at National Airport and Crystal City, and we were very impressed with the organization, the dedication. We're running 12-hour shifts. It's great to be able to actually see what's being done. It gives you a different level of appreciation as we talk about capital budget and safety related matters. I just want to compliment the GM and his team on a great job. We're out there with them for about 5 hours.
Thank you for doing that. I already thanked Christian for doing that, but that was over and above the call of duty for you on a Saturday, so thank you for doing that. Dennis, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. So today, staff begins a more detailed review of the GM's FY 2020 proposed budget, beginning with this committee. As part of WMATA's annual budget process, staff also received 27 questions to which responses have been provided to the board. I will start today, Mr. Chairman, with an overview of the budget that the GM proposed 2 weeks ago, and then cover some of the questions related to the operating budget, which we have categorized, as you see on this slide, into four groups: fair policy, service and new customer service, operating subsidy, and budget outlook. So to recap, the main goals of the operating budget that the general manager proposed on November 1 include the following: including ridership and enhancing customer experience, maximizing operating efficiency, non-fair revenues and employee engagement, and staying within the mandated 3% base subsidy contribution growth cap for Metro. As we noted during the last committee conversation, the proposed budget does not include increased fares or reduced service. It also meets, as I said a few seconds ago, WMATA's 3% base subsidy growth cap. In addition, the proposal maintains the current hours of service, returns trains to ATO, and enhances late-night service delivery by enhancing our partnerships with the private sector. And to drive ridership, the proposed budget reduces current pass prices, introduces new passes, and adds plus to all Metro Rail passes. As a reminder, the proposed FY 2020 operating budget has two key segments: the base budget and the above allowable base, above the base budget. The base budget is based on the 3% mandated subsidy cap, as I described a little bit earlier, which is $32 million, and you see this more on the next slide. The other segment includes the legislatively excluded initiatives, including Silver Line ramp-up costs and new customer initiatives that are designed to drive ridership, which the GM just alluded a few minutes ago. Fair policy. The first group of questions that we received relates to fair policy and the impact on board ridership and revenues. Over the last 2 years, WMATA has taken steps to improve reliability, beginning with SafeTrack and now a proactive systemic preventive maintenance program. WMATA has also invested resources to improve the customer experience, including the rush hour promise, which targets, as you've seen in the next slide, WMATA's largest customer travel base. What WMATA has not done up till now is leveraging pricing as part of a holistic strategy to drive ridership rather than just to raise revenue. This slide, Mr. Chairman, shows WMATA's customer ridership intensity, with core customers riding the system more frequently than day trippers and weekend visitors. As Metro service reliability improves and as the mobility landscape becomes much more competitive, the proposed budget leverages pricing to help WMATA attract and retain customers. So before describing specific pass offerings proposed for FY 2020, I want to underscore that the combined package is designed to unlock the full ecosystem of Metro's bus and rail network. It's also designed to enable WMATA to compete include rideshare services. Individually, and this is one of the questions I was asked, the weekly bus pass reduction targets our most price-sensitive riders and a transit mode where we continue to lose riders. This proposal could generate $700,000 additional trips and cost $1.8 million. The $2 flat fare, again, takes into account the fact that maintenance activities are occurring with some frequency on weekends, and that it also allows customers, in this particular case, tourists, not to have to calculate how much it will cost them to ride rail on weekends. But taken together, these changes are intended to be revenue neutral, or well, it's slightly positive, but it's expected to drive ridership for Metro while reducing WMATA's administrative costs to operate the fare collection process. One of the questions that staff received is about the interim performance of Rush Hour Promise. As of October 2018, WMATA has provided 57 trips during rush hour, of which about 266,000 trips were subject to the credits, costing WMATA about $1 million. The committee will recall that staff projected that rush hour promise will cost about $3 million. So far, it's costing much less than estimated, but more significantly, 93% of those that have received credits are still right in the system. In terms of new services, the slide shows WMATA's major cost operating cost drivers. As you can see from this slide, over 80% of WMATA's operating cost is for personnel, energy, and paratransit services. The remaining portions of the budget, while discretionary, also go to support WMATA's ability to run bus and rail services for our customers. But as WMATA has worked to control or to hold the line on operating costs, operating revenues, however, have continued to erode due to factors that we've talked about here, from markets to fuel to telework to changes in employment patterns. As this slide shows, WMATA's passenger revenues, not total revenues, but passenger revenues, grew on average 6% a year from 2008 to 2013. Since then, average passenger revenues has fallen about 2% on average each year. And we anticipate the future passenger growth, or revenue growth, may be flat at best, putting significant pressure on both WMATA and the region. Another question that staff received requested information about the operating subsidy that will be required if the Blue, Orange, and Silver Line are phased in as part of the general manager's proposal to go to all ACAL trains. The table that you're looking at phases those lines in and results in a $3 million reduction from the $20 million subsidy request, of which $2.6 million is from the Blue Line and about $400,000 comes from the Orange and Silver Line phase-in process. This slide, again, in response to your request, shows the historical revenue miles from FY15 to FY18. The next category of questions relates to operating subsidy. The committee saw this table 2 weeks ago, showing a breakdown of operating subsidy contribution for FY2020. The base subsidy, which is the second line from the top, shows the 3% or $32 million growth that I described earlier, which is consistent with the mandated cap legislation. The remaining subsidy requirements, as you can see, are tied to new customer initiatives and those legislative exclusions that I described earlier. The slide which was provided to the board about a week ago provides additional details or breakdown of the subsidy contributions from the jurisdictions, and we will respond to questions that the committee may have on that. If you jump to the operating budget outlook, this slide shows staff's near-term revenue, expenses, and subsidy projections for WMATA, incorporated in this particular case, current projections with respect to Silver Line operations. No other new initiatives or exclusions are incorporated here, but knowing what we know in terms of changing markets, these numbers could change by the time we get to FY 21 or 23. With that, Mr. Chairman, in terms of next steps, staff will seek committee authorization for public hearing docket next month, followed by a committee work session focused on the capital budget in January. That concludes my presentation, and I'll be glad to respond to questions.
Okay. I have a feeling there may be a number of questions, Dennis, so we'll start out with committee members. But I'd like to start with one, and I was trying to find it in the detailed questions and answers that were provided to the board. On the pass products, right, the rider pass products, it seems like we are well below industry standards on there, and the number of people who use passes seemed incredibly low to me, so a weekly pass or a weekend pass. Could you go a little bit further into that? Where does the organization stand versus other organizations with a weekly, monthly, whatever time period pass? And how will that effectively improve? I can see where you're saying it's going to improve ridership, but how will it improve the financial performance of the organization?
Thank you, Mr. Cochran. You are absolutely right that the percentage of our Metro's customers that use passes is small compared to other transit agencies. I think part of that is obviously a function of our pricing structure. And part of what the recommendation is in FY20 is intended to do is to shift that balance. And while we've designed this program as a whole to be revenue neutral, which means it is not primarily designed to generate additional fares, even though as a whole we expect it may contribute positive revenues. It is much more designed to encourage much more ridership, because when a customer has a pass which they've paid for, then it makes it much more seamless for them to jump on a bus or on a rail and use the pass rather than jump on the alternative service delivery modes that are out there that Metro is competing with. But more fundamentally, if a customer has a pass, assume for a week, that means WMATA cost for managing the media process is much less. It's not incremental as we see on buses. So instead of adding value on a bus for 7 straight days or 5 straight days, you do that transaction once as a transaction, and then you can use it and obviously ride the system much more efficiently. And for us, that's much more effective. For me, in terms of managing the revenue collection process, it means we can reduce the level of resources that we need to manage that process on an ongoing basis. That's one of the reasons why passes are much more efficient as a product and makes your customers, frankly, tied more to you. If you think about it, it's a form of an affinity program. Once you have a pass, you're more likely to use it than when you don't.
Okay. I'll open up to the committee members for other questions. Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What process do you want to use? Because I have a number of questions, but should I just ask one or two at this point?
I would start with the first one.
And go from there?
Yes.
All right. Dennis, as you know, board members just got this yesterday afternoon, your answers to the questions. So I'm going to ask some questions based on just highlighting some concerns from spotting this stuff over the last couple hours. Thank you, sir. Could I ask you a question on fare policy? You have a chart that's entitled A Mission to Improve Ridership, and at the bottom there's number 7, 16, and 14, so I don't know what's the exact reference that I should give it. Now I keep.
It was the first slide, wasn't it?
I guess it was under fare policy, so next one. Here we go. On the left-hand side, I'm fascinated by the statement there on service that for every 10% increase in the number of trains that stop at a platform or station, ridership should be expected to increase by as much as almost 1%. And if you recall, last year when we were discussing the Grosvenor turnbacks, where the increase in sending all the trains to Shady Grove would actually double by 50% the number of trains stopping at stations north of Grosvenor, White Flint, Rockville, Twin Brook, up to Shady Grove, staff came in and said that adding that kind of service wouldn't produce any increase in riders. And I'm curious, when staff changed its mind, when did you come to the conclusion that increasing service, providing better service, as we're going to do on Grosvenor, as you're proposing to do on the east side of the Red Line north of Silver Spring, will actually produce an increase in ridership? Were you not aware of this study when staff was making those statements and submitting that information last year?
Mr. Goldman, the statement that you just referred to is a general proposition. Obviously, that's subject to the unique characteristics of whichever corridors we're looking at. The reference you make respect to Grosvenor refers to the specific analysis tied to that particular corridor based on what's going on at this particular time.
So is that your same position about increasing the period for rush hour trains that you propose, that also won't increase ridership?
The general proposition is correct, which is what you just read.
The general proposition is
yes.
Here.
And the expectation is that increase in those hours, again, and we provided you responses with respect to the headways, the increase in the rush hour period. It does a couple of things, which provided in the responses to the board members. It addresses capacity challenges in those periods. It helps with train management. It helps with maintenance. It helps with the yard services. So, yes, the answer is correct, again, with the proviso that there are unique circumstances surrounding each particular effort that you're looking at, but the general proposition is correct.
So your position is going to be, going forward, that the Grosvenor turnbacks, adding twice as much service, doesn't produce any increase in ridership?
Hey, Mike.
No, that's not what I said.
These questions seem driven to one thing. Could we focus on the budget? Because I haven't heard anything about the budget yet, please.
This is focused on the budget because
get to the question that you would like answered.
If you're going to make this so that we can't conduct any kind of exploration of these issues.
Mike, ask your question, please.
I'll ask one question, I'll go on to another.
Please
one.
Ask the question without all the pontificating, please.
Well, speech making is part of the job. Okay, well, you've indicated that the source of this is something called the VHB, Longitudinal Analysis of Metro Ridership.
That's correct.
Is that document available to board and the public?
Yes.
Is that document on the website?
I do not know. No, it's not.
Okay. Could you make an effort to distribute it to board members and post it on the website so that interested parties, board members, the jurisdictions, and the public at large can take a look at that and see if that supports your statements about elasticity and rider generation of new service?
Thank you.
I have another question. Can I go forward?
Let's see if there's other committee members who would like to ask a question first. Steve, do you have any questions?
Brief question in the form of a statement. Looking at that same paragraph quotation on the left there, whether it's 0% or 0.3% or 0.9%, a 10% increase in the level of service provided to get that level of new ridership. That's a very expensive way to attract new riders, and I think the specific service expansion proposals that were included as part of the budget demonstrate that the cost in terms of additional subsidy of running more trains is in fact very high. So I think this supports what we've seen elsewhere in the analysis as well. It doesn't undermine the general notion that it is very expensive to run more trains when your goal is to attract new riders. Thank you.
Paul and Dennis, if I may interject, how do you balance off rider increase versus, I'm going to call it profit, but it's a bottom line neutrality?
I think we have to take a little bit larger view of it. I mean, that is one of the factors we should look at clearly, the financial part of it. But remember what the role we play in congestion relief, the role we play in the environmental quality, the role we play in attracting economic development. Those are all factors that come into play here. And as hard as we try to be as scientific as we can be, I think the basic logic that the better service you provide, the more service you provide, the better your product is in a competitive market. So that's, the basic philosophy that we're moving under. Obviously, cost is an important issue, but if it's purely a cost, equation, transit in this country does not meet that metric. It just doesn't. That's not what we do. Yeah. We are serving much larger societal goals, and so either we support that to what level is the larger policy issue that's got to be decided. We can continue to try to dig into the mathematical equation of this, but I think as a larger policy issue for the board is where do we want the system to be. And where we're moving it towards, and I think that's really the larger discussion, and it's what we've tried to propose for the board to consider.
If I may, Jim, it's the most efficient allocation of a limited public resource, the money the jurisdictions give us, to provide the maximum amount of public benefit that is our charge. And so, no, it's not, shorthanding as profit is the wrong way of thinking of it, but we have to think about efficiency just like a profit-making business would. Thank you.
And if I could, I mean, that is where we're focusing on the cost side of the equation and everything we can do on that part of it, because I think that's something we can control more, and it's something that's our duty to do.
Yes.
Mike, I believe you said you had another question.
I'll provide you with the details as rather than give you a number that's inaccurate. I don't have the number here with me.
I'm trying to figure out how many people you're training and what's the cost per person trained. I asked this question 2 weeks ago. I for the answer. I said it's a letter of 37 million. On that same subject,
just to be clear, Mr. Goldman, you said you asked this question 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, that question was definitely asked.
Yeah. And my apologies for...
You get an answer. You point out in your answer... You point out in your answer on page 38 that the amount of FTA preventive maintenance money that will be allocated through operating expenses will be continued at the 60 million level that was in the FY19 budget. But you indicate that, and I think this is back on an answer on page 44 or 45, that the board policy on this has varied from between 30 million and 95 million per year. Is that correct?
That's accurate.
Okay. So that, and I think you indicate in that same answer that in terms of preventive maintenance expenses as a category, you've still got 301 million of preventive maintenance expenses that are being funded now in the local budget, in the standard operating budget. Is that how I would correctly read those numbers?
That's accurate.
And so I guess theoretically, you've got at least 37 million there of preventive maintenance money that if the board chose to, could be moved to the capital budget.
That's correct.
That's correct. And that's consistent, as your answers seem to indicate, with the both past board decisions as well as Federal Transit Administration guidelines and practice. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Michael, it's not a courtroom. What is the question?
I'm just trying to make sure that we've got 37 million of ramp-up expenses for the Silver Line, which I would like to capitalize and get out of the operating budget. And so I'm just exploring.
Why don't you ask him whether or not they...
Well, because he said that they can't do that already, and I'm trying to figure out and make sure we can do it a different way by moving some other expenses into the
FCA. But this may not be the venue to look at how we're treating things from an accounting point of view. Perhaps we can do a sidebar in those sort of discussions, quite frankly.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your trying to keep this as a short meeting, and I appreciate that effort on your part.
Okay, thank you.
So I guess just is there a specific question?
So I do appreciate the question, Mr. Goldman. I think the other point that was overlooked in the response is that the general manager's capital program, because this is the interplay between operating and capital, and to the extent that we reduce the level of resources available for capital budget, so that needs to be made up given the plan to invest an average of $1.5 billion a year. So while we do have the capacity, should the board direct us to utilize additional preventive maintenance funds, it will create a gap in the capital budget that needs to be made up.
Well, but does it? That's, I guess, the good question. Does it create a gap in the capital budget? Since of the $500 million in dedicated funding, you've only programmed about $380 million in your FY 2020 budget, so you're essentially going to put in a safe box $120 million of dedicated funding that's being provided with the jurisdictions. Wouldn't this be a source for that $37 million by just increasing the amount of the $500 million in dedicated funding that you'll receive for FY 2020 for use in FY 2020? Isn't that a good policy decision to make?
No. And it's not because, again, if you recall, the overall spend over the next 6 years is about $9 billion. And while the initial anticipated receipts from the dedicated funding will show some early surpluses, those are designed to pay debt service on the back end. So to the extent that that's used now, again, somebody has to make up the difference. That's, again, part of the responses that we provided to the board.
Well, in theory, we can make up the difference
on the back end. I guess if I could, it would be a policy decision that was made by this board. However, isn't that what got this system into trouble over time in the past for underfunding capital projects?
Yes.
And if we are looking to finance things going forward, you have to have a source of revenue in order to pay back those bonds that will be sold.
I'm just explaining the policy issue.
It is a policy,
best
but
use of $120 million is to put in a lockbox for a couple of years, as opposed to using it to reduce the total amount that's being asked.
I believe you would increase. I believe you would increase the bell curve significantly if you had to get money in the future, Mike.
We'll see. Okay. Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? From non-committee members, questions? Corbett. I'm sorry, briefly, I congratulate Mr. Goldman on his diligence and stubbornness. I mean, it is a virtue of sorts, and informative to hear the answers to his questions. In defense of the management, with respect to the comment made by Mr. Goldman earlier on slide 14, suggesting there was an inconsistency of position concerning the effects of increased service on ridership. If staff ever earlier said that the correlation was weak, they may have had in mind a threshold less than 10%, which would produce a negligible impact on ridership. So I don't think there is, I don't think you have stepped into a trap or contradicted yourselves by showing us this statement on slide 14.
Thank you.
So I'll be happy to take these, Mr. Chairman, if these have already been asked in while I was absent. But a couple questions concerning the weekend fare and then the overall pass policy. So with the weekend flat fare, what's the currently on the weekends, what's the average cost of a weekend trip?
We did ask some questions about the passes while you were not here, Christian, so but not this particular one.
Okay.
I can tell you that on rail, the average cost of a trip is about $6.
I'm sorry, say again?
On $6, the average cost of a trip on rail. Obviously, I know your question was with respect to weekend.
Right.
What I just gave you is the average cost for the week. It is conceivable that the weekend cost could be slightly higher.
But it. So the, I'm sorry, the average rail
cost.
Fare paid.
No.
Okay, let's.
You asked.
Sorry.
Cost. Okay.
Sorry. Average rail fare paid.
It's about $3.
$3. Okay. That's helpful. Appreciate it. And as far as passes, my specific thing is, have we considered, given that we have fairly low take-up on passes compared to other transit properties, have we considered rebuilding our pass offerings from the ground up, really rethinking them instead of trying to tweak them and trying to figure out what are other properties using that have higher rates of take-up that we could adapt for our own use?
I'm hesitant because I want to be clear what my answer is intended to convey, which is that most of the time that WMATA has looked at passes or fares in general has been to increase fares in order to balance the budget. This is the first time in the last, at least as long as I've been here, where we're doing it not as a revenue driver, but as a ridership driver. And so the answer to your question is that, yes, we've tried to do some of that with the select pass, with reducing the price when the general manager's budget was introduced last year, keeping the boss pass unchanged. And now we're taking a more holistic review of the fare product to sort of try and use that to not just drive ridership, but also to serve as a hedge against what we're seeing in the marketplace. And the weekend price is particularly relevant in this case because that's where one of the areas where we're seeing our worst performances in terms of ridership. That's where the ride shares are doing phenomenally well against us. And so making it that much easier for our customers to use us on weekends is something that is worth doing, which is why the general manager proposed it.
So if I could,
yeah, this is a great lead into where I want to go next.
Okay.
So thanks.
I've also, we're doing a review of the entire weekend, the types of work we do, if there's other ways to do that, because
mm-hmm.
we're coming at it from both sides. Clearly, what's driving the weekend issues are the capital program and the maintenance program that we have on weekends. Again, it's the balancing of that versus doing it during non-peak hours. or earlier outs in, during the week. So that's the balance. But are there other ways we could do that service and both communicate what we're doing better, but also looking at different ways we could deliver the, get to the same product we're trying to get to, but reducing the impact on the overall system where we can, or focusing on smaller parts of the system and having the other system run at a higher level. So it's a combination of both. But the flat fare is just a recognition of what we have in front of us right now. But we also have to look at how we're actually doing the delivery. And I think the balance of both of those, I think, will help us get both the ridership back and at a minimum, hopefully keep it revenue neutral, if not generate more dollars.
Okay. And then that's perfect. Thank you. So in coming up with the $2 weekend flat fare as well as the other passes, part of the presumption here, it's beyond math. It's predicting what riders will actually do. Did we include rider surveys through our Amplify program or other public participation means to really get at what these specific proposals would look like? So in other words, do we have qualitative data that says a 33% decrease in the weekend fare is actually going to induce ridership?
I'll solicit assistance from my colleague behind the chair.
So the docket that's being produced by the board for the budget that's proposed will include these fare changes, and that public process will include surveys, outreach to the public to get reaction. It will give the board a sense of whether or not those changes are well received by the public and may alter behavior. Our forecasting models don't produce that instantly today. What you see is more of an historic look of when you pull these levers, what happens with customer behavior, and that's what the basis of the projection is.
Okay, so that's the only sort of public public input is based on historical performance. We don't have any contemporaneous public input that's guided these specific proposals.
That's the next step.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, did you have a comment, Dennis? Were you?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I thought there was something coming. Clarence.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very interested in getting into the detail. Just a couple of just observations. Very reluctant to do anything that takes money away from capital. From what we saw out there, you get a much better appreciation of some of the challenges. Very reluctant to pull money away from any of the capital related activities. Globally, I think the Amazon may change the equation some, but at the same time, in the state of Maryland, an increase in subsidy cost has to be offset. So there's no free money. So we have to balance that and try to figure out, again, like Mr. McMillan said, of trying to find that balance. And in that balance, cost and ridership, but also we can't lose sight of safety. So I look forward to the additional conversations that we'll have over the coming months on this topic.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Mr. Goldman? Oh, Steve, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was close, and just a quick one. So looking at the proposed service expansions, two of those, granted the service expansions on the Maryland side will have a beneficial effect for D.C. and Virginia Riders as well, but am I correct that while the actual new service of items 2 and 3 there are focused in Maryland, that additional subsidy cost beyond the 3% of $4.2 million, that would actually flow through the formula and be shared among the jurisdictions, or would that predominantly be an increase of the Maryland subsidy contribution?
It will flow, as you indicated, through the formula allocation throughout the region.
Okay. So the additional Maryland service that would be result from those two proposals would be shared throughout, the cost of that would be shared by the entire region. Thank you.
Mike.
Can I turn to, I think, slide 18? It's on the operating subsidy. There it is. Dennis, in this slide, the I guess this is the slide that you distributed a week ago, and the Maryland increase you now show is $456 million. And just the background of this, while you're showing a 10% increase, if you actually go back to the amount that was voted last year for FY19, $380 million, the increase is about 20% for FY20 compared to FY19 for Maryland, 20%.
That would be true for all jurisdictions, an increase in percentages, correct?
I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe that's a good follow-up question for you or Mr.
I think it was a statement more than a question.
But I guess my question is, this has seemed, at least for Maryland, from the first reiteration of subsidy, increased the subsidy by about $20 million. From about 440 to 400 and or 430 to 456 million. I'm trying to understand what was the mathematics or the methodology that resulted in that change, because you're not changing the total amount of the subsidy. The total amount of the subsidy proposed is the 1.2 billion. So I'm trying to understand why Maryland's share and perhaps Virginia's share increased over from the first reiteration of this slide to the slide that you distributed last week.
The if you recall, the direction from the board was that we needed to adjust the subsidy for FY20 to accommodate the Silver Line ramp-up cost. And that's one, and to make sure that we complied with the 3% mandate.
Right, but those costs were there because the total subsidy hasn't changed.
That's correct.
So there's some mathematics or some formula.
Which is what I'm trying to explain.
Okay.
So we started from the proposition that the overall growth for the base subsidy needed to be at 3%. So that meant that, and if you look at the slide, the table in front of you,
okay,
the aggregate growth in this case is 3%. The growth for the district is 3%. The growth for the Commonwealth is 3%. And the growth for Maryland is 3%. I think when you look at this and the prior numbers, you'll see where the changes occurred. But that was, this is the law, and this complies with that with respect to the base. There was a change. There was a change. And in this case, it manifested itself primarily in Maryland with respect to that change. But it's in compliance with the law that the state of Maryland and the Commonwealth passed, you know, capping aggregate growth for both states at 3%.
I guess I'm not following, but somehow, so what you're saying is somehow the mathematics of the formula to increase the 3% growth produced an increase of the subsidy burden for Maryland of $20 million?
Which still keeps Maryland under the cap of 3%.
At 3%. Right. Okay, so it's not a change in how you calculated the so-called legislative exclusions?
No.
Or the new initiatives?
No.
It's all back on this
exactly
cap issue?
Exactly.
Okay. We'll let the experts take a look at that.
Okay.
Can I just ask one more question? On slide 15?
Okay. No one else seeking recognition? Acting chair.
Please, take over.
Is anyone else? Any other member seeking recognition? If not, go ahead, Mr. Goldman.
On slide 15, in the this chart on historic, scheduled, and actual Metro Rail revenue miles, what's fascinating here is in FY17, the actual was 15% below budget. Is that because the reliability was so poor, the service was so poor in FY17 that produced such a variance from what had been budgeted and scheduled?
Rather than say that, I will say that in an FY16, WMATA started to save track, which impacted the system and continued that in through 17. And obviously, we've gone into a more systemic maintenance process. So that impacted the level of service on the system as a whole.
Okay, and then the improvement from FY17 to FY18, I assume that was a result of the extending of the headways and reducing of the services so that it reduced the budgeted revenue miles from 97, I guess these are millions, to 87 million. Is that what produced the reduction in the budgeted amount of revenue miles from in 18 compared to 17?
No. What obviously, as we gain better knowledge about expected actions on the system itself, we are trying to calibrate the mileage on the system to the budget itself. Obviously, as you can see, we exceeded it, you know, as things improved, you know, in FY18. But it's a process of trying to estimate what's going to happen, the level of work on the tracks, and ultimately the what we're seeing on ridership on the system.
Right, but what I'm trying to get to is not what actually was run, but actually the budget number. The budget number is down by 10, whatever these are, 10
right.
million or whatever.
Right. That's what I'm saying. You know, we expected, you know, less ability to run service, but obviously the improvements that the team has made, you know, allowed them to actually run more service.
What I'm saying, isn't this the budget year where the board voted longer headways, so reducing the total number of operations and train trips on the system? Doesn't that account for the drop of 10 million in the budgeted number?
No. Well, maybe I don't understand your question. I've given you the reasons why there's a variance between the budgeted numbers and the actuals.
Okay. Well, in 18, where the actual is higher than the budgeted numbers, is that a planned event, or is that just an ad hoc response to, you know, like the demonstrations, the Women's March, and things like that? And
right. Those events end up driving the average number of miles. Obviously, we went into that process recognizing that there will be maintenance work at the system and tried to frame or structure the budget in a way that includes those. But as you've seen increased activity here, that some of those contribute to the additional miles that you've seen in respect to the rail.
Okay, but what I'm trying to understand is the increase a response to perception that there was a need for better service on some lines, that there was a need for more trains during rush hour?
If I could, I think it's a number of issues that played out, and it's not one. I think it was, some of it was the reliability of the cars, right? That changed during this time period. The Safe Track came about, and came about very quickly. All right. I think we were putting out a schedule that we weren't meeting, so we were assuming that we were going to get there, and we weren't delivering. So what we've done is, as we've tightened that up, both in terms of getting the cars more reliable, getting the tracks more reliable, getting a schedule that we could hit, that's what's drive both of these numbers to start to turn the other way. I don't think it's one issue. I think it's the combination of all those, but it's a reflection of being more realistic what we can deliver and providing a better product of what we do deliver. So that's what I believe is playing out here.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
David, yeah.
Thank you. Again, in defense of management, I think Mr. Wiedefeld has politely omitted an additional reason for the variance, which is that because revenue is attributed to these revenue miles in a budget that's approved by the board is sort of complicit in this variance, because if we assume that revenue will be healthy, we are deferring the hard issue of subsidy, right? We kick the can. So this shouldn't be laid exclusively at the feet of management. I think collectively we going forward need as a board to scrutinize the quality of revenue mile forecasts and the quality of projections of revenue attributed to those revenue miles, and address the hard decision of subsidy early rather than later in the process.
If I may ask a question, David, were you done?
I am.
Okay. Slide number 14, please, or I think it's just one before this. So on this question here, is this the proposal from management to increase 8-car trains? So if you, on the top there, it says expand all 8-car trains would be $10.3 million increase, correct?
Yes.
And then below that, if we defer blue and defer orange and silver, there's a savings of $3.0 million.
That's correct.
Ballpark. So is that an actual proposal, or is that just outlining a plan? For instance, how much would we save if we did reduce the red line to all 6-car trains, or the yellow and green lines? It certainly seems to every line that runs through Virginia is being reduced there.
Well, so the GM's proposal is for expansion of 8-car trains to all lines. Mr. Goldman requested an analysis of what a deferral of those lines will mean. And what we've done here is simply share with the board.
So this is just an answer to a question. This
yes.
is not a proposal.
That's correct.
Can we follow up on that?
Sure, I was going to. Okay. But what would we save if we were to do that with the red line and the other lines, too? How would that break out with each line?
We obviously, I mean, if you don't do it at all, obviously, it's the entire amounts related to those lines.
Be another 7 million.
It to some degree,
right?
Yeah.
10 million.
Well, in addition to the 3, right? It's there already on the bottom. But I understand. It was just an answer to a question, not a proposal by management. Okay.
Can I just follow up on this
sure.
issue, Mr. Corcoran? So just can you give us a sense of, as you develop this phasing plan, I think the original proposal had them phasing in a sequence. What was the rationale behind the sequencing of how that was done?
It was dealing with the capital program that we have. It had nothing to do with it. Literally was when we could physically do it, given other things we were doing, is what
okay.
it was tied to.
Okay.
Because we'll be shutting down parts of the system and things like that. It just when you play that out is what drove that.
Okay.
The cost to expand all 8-car trains is down here at $10.3 million. I assume that would be for all the lines in FY 2020. This is a very elementary, simplistic question, but since you don't need, since you already bought the trains, 7,000 of them, and you don't need to hire any more operators to extend the train from 6 cars. Why is there a $10 million increase in cost to operate 8-car trains?
So that's a combination of additional consumption for power, mileage maintenance, and other costs associated with that. It is not related to additional staffing.
Can you break that down as to how much it is propulsion, how much it is maintenance workers and other factors?
Yes.
And Mr. Dorsey, I believe in our initial presentation on the 8-car trains, we outlined the logic between of why it was phased in. It's in that document, so
okay.
I'll pull it back up.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other further questions or comments? All right. With that, then, I'd like to bring this meeting to adjournment. And I believe we're starting at 11 o'clock next door, Mr. Chairman. So we have a 15-minute break or so before the board meeting starts at 11 o'clock next door. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job.